Hi, Mage fans, it's your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast, and joining me today is Pook from Changeling the Podcast, and we are adding another installment to our Strange Peoples in Mage and the World of Darkness series. We had foolishly thought that we could get through our original list in the original time allotted, and then Pook literally mentioned anything to do with Changeling, which resulted in me for 45 minutes going, "What's that? What's that? What's that?"
It is a deadly road to tread.
It is. It is. 'Tis a dangerous trod. Mm-hmm. And this is before we even start rifling through Chronicles of Darkness to steal change from its pockets. I still want to do an episode on the True Fae there, and it's pretty fascinating.
The Gentry?
I guess.
Yeah.
Let's start with one that you and I both had on our lists, the cool people. The Sacrana, which... Axis Mundi, Book of Spirits, has a bunch of entries that are absolutely fascinating to me. They are these praying mantis spirits, looking spirits that wear long flowing robes and the zucchetto of a cardinal, which I assume when they said a cardinal's hat is what they're referring to. They consider it rude to question their origins and find it embarrassing to answer personal questions. And I just love that.
Can I just read this quote?
Yes.
So, it is unknown exactly what created the Sacrana, and they are somewhat embarrassed to explain their origins, finding the question rude. "Must an origin be postulated?" one told Medea Moondaughter of the Black Furies. "Very well, we are the splinter of the splinter of the great trickster's nightmare when he contemplated religion and rationality. And your own line of descent, evolution-wise, no doubt related to the canines of the Miocene epoch with a dash of sapiens thrown in. Family reunions must be quite trying." Perfection. So rare is it for, like, the first 100 words of anything in the World of Darkness to give you so much, to lift so much weight. So
those are load-bearing words.
Yeah.
And my next note I had is they describe themselves as a splinter of a nightmare of the great trickster who is trying to ponder religion and rationality. Many were destroyed by the Anunnaki. I wish Werewolf had more awkward combinations. So you have the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm. I'm more interested about where these things kind of run into each other. To me, this is an interesting combination of where the Wild and the Weaver kind of coalesce. They embody themselves in a realm that is somewhat near the Flux Realm, and they guard a garden named the Guerinage, where all is order, but whose edges are great tears. They don't visit the Weaver realms and tend to wait for challenges and questions. They seem to be exceptionally refined for creatures that feel such a strong tie to the wild. So the question to me is, what kind of change do they embody? And one of them to me is the idea that they are pent up change. They are the layer, I don't want to quite say of repression, but kind of that pre-conscious moment where things haven't quite fully formed, or when impossible stasis and infinite change kind of run into each other, and their kind of pondering of religion versus rationality kind of runs into it, because frequently it is the case that people try and make sense of religion, but it is often the case to me that religion makes sense. And I want kind of more paradoxical embodiments, that they are the lovely side of chaos rather than the confusing and concerning side of it, that they represent the chaos of an ordered garden where you still have these organic and biological forms that are fighting against each other. They tend to be intellectually flexible, they can teach communication, and have philosophical deconstructivism as a hobby, which I'm generally going to support as long as it stays at the hobby level. But that's just me. What did you like about the Sacrana?
So in relation to what you're saying, I don't know enough about werewolf's kind of deep cosmology. My recollection is that you have the Weaver, the Worm, and the Wild. And the Weaver went mad, caught the worm in her web, and that's what corrupted the worm or something.
Yeah, that's along one option. Lines.
Something, something.
Yeah.
To me, they almost seem like a relic of pre-madness Weaver. So they have that orderliness, but it's not, you know, they're not trying to capture anything. They're not trying to enforce order on anything. They're just, here it is. And when you think about the collision between any two of those three forces, it makes me think about how a non-confrontational putting juxtaposition, I guess, of one and the other, it heightens the sense of both. So they are asking all these sort of philosophical quandaries and very regimented in their behavior and everything, but they only seem so hyper Weaver because they are surrounded by Wild. So it's that, I'm sure there's like a term in visual perception.
I would bring up the concept of Eigengrau, where through contrast, the range of perception becomes deeper. If you look at the black around a very bright object, like between around a pinpoint of light, is perceived as darker than true black. So if you were to just obscure the entirety of your vision, that phenomenon is known as Eigengrau.
I like that. I mean, yeah. I understood the word without before you explained it.
And so I do like the idea that they don't like the Weaver because they're from the pre-madness era. To me, they are the embodiment of philosophy as process. I like the idea that they kind of embody the idea that you won't necessarily come to conclusions, but the process is a type of refinement of self. The people go to them looking for answers, but what they emerge with are more a set of tools, that they don't play chess to win, but they play chess to perform the individual moves. The garden does not have an end state, but the process of pruning and paring and so on is something that is kind of continuous. So I like the idea that they are kind of this bulwark against ascension.
Yeah.
People that have an end state that they're going to, the Sakrana are like, is that really what you want?
I wonder, in a sense, I don't know what their inspiration was for all of this, but it reminds me, it's almost like medieval philosophical theology or theological philosophy, where the exercise of pondering is an attempt to get closer to God. It's not, you are not becoming, you are not ascending, you are not getting there, but the act itself is a form of, I guess, purification through that context. It's almost like that, except presumably occasionally the females bite off the heads of the males after mating because they're praying mantises.
And super hot, anyway.
Yeah.
But
I love it. It's just like, it's almost like they had a bunch of ideas in a bowl and just like picked four at random and put them together.
We also get that with the idea of Schiaflinax, one of my favorite umbral entities. I also like the idea that they are an embodiment to... Have you ever had a conversation with someone where it was very obvious that you were talking about the same phenomenon, but from two wildly different forms of assessment?
It's like every family reunion I've ever been to.
I like the idea that the Sakrana are like, they are the embodiment of, are you even asking the right question?
Mm.
And that they are there and they just are relentless in challenging your premises, in challenging your first beliefs and your first thoughts, and that they can do that endlessly against a hermetic or endlessly against a virtual adept or endlessly against a dream speaker, that there is no one immune to their kind of introspection. And I don't know if this is a place where you go to recover from quiet or if centuries of this could even like deprogram a Nefandus or if they're just there as these weird entities you see passing through. I like the idea that they are almost impossible to fight and that their bodies yield nothing of use in magical research. And they're just this present reminder that the world is bigger and weirder than you think it is.
More things on earth and heaven, Horatio, et cetera. Yeah. Mangling quotes. I have in my notes, I'm curious, because this is a werewolf book, we get information that they like stargazers. They're neutral to almost every other kind of werewolf, and they're hostile to glasswalkers and bone gnawers specifically. So with relation to mages, I would imagine they don't care for technocrats at all. But all other mages, it would probably be less about their belief structure and more about their approach to that belief structure. So if you are a cerebral... considering Nefandus or a dream speaker or a hermetic, like, you are equally welcome. But if you are the dream speaker who's all about, you know, blood and guts, and maybe that's more verbatim.
Yeah.
Or if you're an ecstatic or whatever, it's like, no, that's not what we do. You know, we are here to have a Socratic dialogue. And I like the idea of their realm being neutral ground, full stop. So you may want to slay every Nefandus that you meet, but if you are in that garden and the Nefandus is having a chess game, you are going to sit down and have your chess game next to them, and you better behave.
I also like the idea that their realm is utterly devoid of anything otherwise useful.
Yes.
That people think there are great things there, and they just keep running into the Sakrana who are like, what are you trying to do?
Yeah. Well, I can imagine finding out about their realm, a mage might go and try to get some piece of obscure lore or knowledge or whatever, but they're going to make you work for it. And you're going to have to go through almost a seeking in order to get that little piece of historical whatever. And I love the idea of it because they are so patronizing. I mean, the bit in here about...
You're just constantly making willpower rolls to avoid throwing over the chessboard.
Well, so we get the information that for Chiminage, Garu can gain a dot of intelligence by devouring them or one of their arms. So mages might not have to get that extreme, but... You know, it raises the question, what does a mage have to do in order to win some kind of reward from them? So they will definitely be showing up in the next Umbra game that I run, regardless of game line.
Most certainly. What next did you have?
So I have the Trulorvia. So the Trulorvia, they first turn up in Blood-Dimmed Tides, then Infinite Tapestry, where they're given some more mage-specific information. But basically, they are an ancient and malevolent life force from under the sea, which possesses humans and invertebrates, specifically, especially cephalopods. And then the process of Trulorviosis, which I think is my favorite game term in the entire World of Darkness. It slowly taints a host and mutates them into an alien-minded entity when one of the Trulorvia, appendages gets hold of them. It's all very Lovecraftian, and the exact nature of what the Trulorvia is and where it comes from is left vague. There's speculation. So there are shapechangers who say the similarity to Bane possession means this is obviously an expression of the worm. The Rokea Weresharks are the ones kind of putting that forward. They're also immune to possession, so they fight the minions of the Trulorvia. Mages have little concrete information, but Infinite Tapestry has an Aetherite lab in, surprise, surprise, Baltimore, the surprisingly resilient junior mage studying a specimen they found. What the Trulorvia wants, enacted through its host, is slightly clearer, and that is the overwhelming and subjugation of the land, light, and heat by the cold, dark waters. So it is a population that has direct rules and suggestions for mage. Blood-Dimmed Tides provides mechanics for resisting or curing the infection of Trulorviosis with high amounts of life and spirit. And the book also talks about needing high willpower to resist the control of the Petirani caste, the possessors. Infinite Tapestry casts it as an umbral virus that followed explorers back to Earth. There's also the joint Pentex Technocracy initiative of Project Deepwater as a story hook possibility, since they've undoubtedly stirred up things they shouldn't have down in the trenches. And because Blood-Dimmed Tides established that if you go down deep enough, you can cross over into the Umbra very easily, presumably that's how this entity found its way back into Earth. I'm not sure if Book of the Worm kind of goes into it further, but...
I like that idea of weird things that have moved back and forth across the barrier a couple of times. Mm. And in the same way that we have bygones, which are creatures that have undergone ephemeralization, I wish there were more examples of things that kind of went the other way. I think in some of my writing for Victorian kind of suggests that there are areas where the gauntlet is thin or where reality zones are shifting over, that creatures kind of wander into the Umbra, change, and then kind of wander back. And that is maybe a source of potential cryptids. I think I had the Golden Beaver of Canada as being one of the creatures. I don't remember which ones I fully indicated, but like certain folk creatures are actually the result of this passage back and forth. How do you feel about the presentation of the Myrrh?
In general, or
in terms of Blood-Dimmed Tides, was that something where you're like, this is interesting?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's a solid, I mean, it's a mini Kith book inside a wonderful book. Yeah, no. I quite like it. In relation, though, to using the Trulorvia as a population, I wanted to mention that there are a few different subtypes. You have the Enfolded, who are humans infected by the spirit virus, and they slowly grow like anemone tendrils or a squid beak or other deep sea features. The vector of transmission is left up to the storyteller, but the suggestion we get is an injected toxin. And once they can't pass as human, they go down into the depths where they may eventually become the elders, who are basically krakens that retain a single vestige of their human form.
Yep.
There's some suitably creepy description in Blood-Dimmed Tides, like having all these tentacles, but then like baby fingers.
Yes.
And then the other main case is the Petirani, and those are cephalopods that burrow mind control tentacles into a human skull and work them like a marionette. Or a puppet, I suppose. Kind of like the Illithids in D&D, the Mind Flayers. So they're malevolent and narcissistic more than sadistic.
The thing that got me about it is their plan kind of depends on it being this subtle creeping terror. I don't know how they take over, though. Like, once you become aware of them, it's not like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where you have a growing population like, oh, these obvious squid people that are comparatively slow to reproduce and don't seemingly have access to advanced weaponry and are limited to the ocean. Whatever will we do besides continuing to poison them through the operations and machinations of humanity? That to me is where, like, there's that's question mark profit in the Underpants Gnomes three-step operation. But yeah, there's also something Geiger-esque kind of in the biological violence that they seemingly do unto you. How do you see these coming up in a game?
If you're doing a Lovecraftian horror take on Mage, I think it certainly works, because one of the questions that is always lurking in the background for me in a Mage setting is, if something is severe enough of a threat, why hasn't the technocracy done anything about it yet?
Or something.
So the way that I would use them is position them. If I had to draw a media analog, it would be like the penultimate episode of the first season of Star Trek: The Next Generation, Conspiracy.
Ah, the Bluegills.
Yes. Yeah. So there's like a few specific people in key positions, all of whom are slowly arranging themselves from the moment when they will pull the trigger on some grand plan, whether that's suddenly the oceans rise up and flood everything, whether that's jellyfish have suddenly infested everywhere. But yeah, I think that you can go in that direction, or just have Krakens rising up and eating things.
Yeah.
Do Cloverfield as a Mage game, like whatever. I think they make good foes for the Kopalue, or if you're doing an older setting, House Tharsis. You can go out on the unexplored seas and run into some of these critters. Limited, but...
How do you feel about the Deep Ones angle, where there is just this New England fishing village that has been taken over by these creatures?
Again, why hasn't the technocracy done anything about it?
Yeah, I think it's partially just because it's a quaint New England fishing village and they couldn't actually tell the difference.
I like that. It's like, why is Stepford in Connecticut? You figure it out.
Left as an exercise to the reader. But yeah, I like the idea of alternatively introducing the Returned, which is this next level where they look utterly human but are being that kind of remotely controlled thing. And we also get the idea that it's like, okay, the humans become more cephalopodic,
yes,
cephalopodian, and the cephalopods become more human. We don't get too much information on that going to its full extent. And maybe you have, they've retrofitted down nuclear submarines or something like that. There's a Broken Arrow incident and they're trying to figure out, and that is how they wage war. So suddenly having an umbral cephalopodic spirit creature with access to nuclear weapons, that feels Mage to me. That feels sufficiently Mage.
Yeah.
And then you get to do the technocracy traditions, Kopalue joint strike force to take out the vampire squid nuclear submarine.
With the hyper-evolved Lisa Frank dolphins in the Vanguard.
Yeah. It's like, well, we can't introduce them. They would just solve it for us.
Yeah.
That's a level above why hasn't the technocracy just taken care of this. Any other thoughts on the Chilvoria?
I wouldn't want to play one, but I like that they get camouflage powers and pressure resistance. Mm-hmm. Like even in their human form, it's like, yeah, that's cool.
That seems to make sense.
Presumably they can like shoot ink out of their nostrils or something.
I have similarly chosen a cephalopodic group.
Oh boy.
That we get. So it's like Infinite Tapestry has some, but so does Book of Worlds. We get Cephalopoda Malefica, the Watchers in the Deep, which are listed as alien horrors. These are squid monsters that look like vampire squids. They are radially symmetric as opposed to bilaterally symmetric, because Book of Worlds was one of the books where the authors are like, I have a big word and I'm going to use it. And I'm excited for them because I remember being their age when that book was written too.
Yeah.
And being like, yes, I am going to tell you what metempsychosis means. There are four types, the base C. Malefica, as well as three subspecies that do specialized types of work. You have the warriors, the spies, and the behemoths. We don't get physical descriptions for them, except to note that they can vary considerably. The smallest of them can fit into a dream speaker's breathing canal. I like that they specifically mention dream speaker. Yeah. Which on one level is like menacing, but on another, it's like, okay, so you're caught by dream speaker snot. You really should have thought this through.
Is the term breathing canal actually a thing people use? Like, airway would make sense to
me. It might have been airway.
Passages. Like, I understand the phrase, but I don't think I've ever heard it.
Breathing canal?
Breathing canal.
I mean, it's usually alimentary canal, and that is used for the food tube.
Yeah.
Ugh. The root species of C. malefica is exceptionally patient, and they are encountered in the deep sea and the deep universe. And then that deep umbra tie. In second edition, the deep sea kind of went directly via portals to the deep umbra, which, sure, fine. A bunch of them coalesced at some point in history and said, we are all. And all was capital, and it was capital A all. So we get the vague idea that this is some sort of a group intelligence or hive mind. They are capable of extensive genetic experimentation and tend to work very slowly on long timescales. The Progenitor Society of Aether and Virtual Adepts have encountered them in a number of places. So these are vampire space squids to differentiate from the star squids of the Nafandi. Although there being a war between the two, I'm here for. They're suggested as hating all quote-unquote bony life and are listed as being either responsible for eliminating all life that was on the COP, the Copernicus Research Station, before the Void Engineers found it, or it is their creation. So they have kept zoos of various types, which have fallen into the hands of humans, and their genetic material is the basis for the cephalopod guardians created from the Progenitors, again, not to be confused with the hyperintelligent cetaceans, which are obviously ruling the progenitors as of at least revised. They can have immense amounts of health, multiple arms, each with their own individual health pools, each capable of attack. They can do chameleon coloring too. They're capable of jet propulsion. They can move at 40 miles per hour in water or hundreds of miles per hour in space. They can be very smart, but very slow. They kind of take long periods of time. Now, the question is, do you think they wage war on the Chovoria, or do you think they're in some way their agents? I like the idea that they want to cleanse the bony ones for their susceptibility to Chovoriosis, which is a massive threat to them. And they just have this almost religious war, this Butlerian jihad against them, and want to destroy Earth for that reason before it gets too far, that they just kind of view us as Typhoid Marys, as it were, just going around the cosmos, potentially spreading Chovoriosis wherever our bony fingers happen to lay. Or did they create this, and that is their way of slowly taking over humanity?
I think I lean more towards the first, because the Chulorvia don't really seem to have, well, or at least we don't get any designs that are beyond Earth.
Yeah.
And I imagine from the perspective of, what is it, Cephalopoda malefica?
Yep.
Yeah, yes. I imagine they would look at the Chulorvia as being very small time. You know, like, it's not even worth their efforts, but if they do run into them, they will just tentacle smack them back down to the oceans. Be like, go try to flood Earth. Fine, whatever.
Have fun.
If an enfolded Void Engineer, for example, did get off of Earth and caught their attention, then maybe that would flag and say, oh, now this is a problem we have to worry about. Who their agents would be to actually do something about it, I don't know. Maybe the Nafandi or something, but
they are listed as being capable of immense genetic modification. So I like the idea that C. malefica genetic material could allow you to do wild xenotransplantation. That if you really want to be a werewolf, get their skin, get some of their genetic material, and now, Sam Haight, eat your heart out. We can do some, radical stuff involving that.
Are you familiar with the Blade trilogy? So you know how in Blade 2 they introduced the variety of vampire where the entire lower jaw expands into? That's what I imagine. Getting some of that material into a vampire or because they're vampiric. So
this is the problem with exploration, the Dark Forest issue raised by Three Body Problems, Song of Distant Earth, or whatever the actual series is called, and being like, oh no, this is how the mages have doomed us. They have brought us to the attention of C. malefica, and they shall be our doom. And that is the way in which mages are monsters within the world of darkness. But I do like the fact that we have two different squid-based, deep umbral, possibly mundane threats from deep space / the ocean.
Do you think that the Ascension War could just be a proxy war between them? Like, they're just manipulating factions of mages?
Oh, that would be interesting. I feel like it could be the space squids versus the star squids versus the sea squids. Mm-hmm. That could kind of be the trichotomy that you go for.
And the dolphins are here to save us, but nobody will listen.
No one will. They don't have thumbs. Yeah. They can't. If they were able to text, maybe we'd be okay. Or they're literally just speaking Dutch if you slow the squeaks down enough, and no one has figured that out yet. Every time they hear the dolphin do it, they're like, aw. And no one's thought to record it and just play it back slowly, and they actually speak perfect French or something.
Yeah.
Something a little bit more obscure than that. Like, all dolphins speak Occitanian? Where did this even come from?
Ascension is just the echolocation you made along the way.
So who do you have next?
So next up, I have the Wick So W-Y-C-K. Fun fact about this word. I learned it from the 1993 Agnieszka Holland directed Secret Garden film. It is a dialect, I think North English word for alive, full of life. It's cognate with quick, as in the quick of the quick and the dead. So it's the same root. I do wonder if the authors of Mage also learned it from that film since it came out around the same time, but neither here nor there. Yeah, etymology. In the World of Darkness, they are the OG mages, at least from the perspective of, I guess, English specifically, verbena, because they're using that term. We find direct information about them mainly in verbena material, but also Isle of the Mighty for changeling slash mage. I have, again, a quote from Tradition Book Verbena Revised, where it says, "The Wick were the first true mages, born of mortal flesh and primal spirit. They were the first ones to reach out with their hands and their wills to shape the world to suit their needs and their wishes. Their power was like nothing we, their descendants of blood and spirit, now possess. For them, magic was almost effortless, a part of their very being. They didn't require tools and rituals to work their wills, making them the equal of the greatest masters our tradition has ever known. Greater, even." So, there you go. The suggestion here, and in the original tradition book as well, is that they're at the root of the fertility deity Mithim specifically. They may have been gods themselves, or maybe just demigods. For traditionalists who like to cast Lilith as the first mage, she sometimes is included as one of the Wick. In Britain, they apparently hung out with the Tuatha De Danann, and the Tuatha also get thrown in as a possible name for them. So lots of muddy waters here. They built Stonehenge, they rode griffins, they founded the verbena. Like the ancient fae, there are persistent rumors that some of them have survived in isolation, but the overarching theme is that they're godlike immortals who transcended human needs, helped humanity move forward before vanishing and letting the children they guided fend for themselves. So really kind of the mage, or at least verbena equivalent of the Tuatha. So that's how I see them. The most likely way that non-verbena characters would hear about them is the Paths of the Wick. This is one of the names for enduring paths through the other worlds. They appear as spooky trails through dreamlike, mist-shrouded forests, going from basically anywhere to basically anywhere else. And even though they're said to be gone, they get mentioned repeatedly, which I feel like is permission for a storyteller to drop them into a game. I know I've used them once, and I enjoy featuring them.
Oh, interesting. How did you use them in the game?
Just, you know, players need to get from point A to point B, and you have no better way to do it.
Oh, the Paths of the Wick. Got it.
The Paths. Yeah, not the Wick themselves. Sorry.
One of the things I really like is that it specifically mentions that the Paths of the Wick, many only lead yards.
Yes.
So someone being like, we shall take the Paths of the Wick.
You go all the way to the other side of the village.
Exactly. You went from the living room to the kitchen. Congratulations. We have a hallway that does that quite nicely and does not incur paradox.
Space seemed much bigger before planes.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, what it comes down to. But the permutations of it are fun to think about. I don't know if you're a fan of the Wheel of Time series.
Unfamiliar.
All right. So in the Wheel of Time, there's what's called the Ways. And it's very similar. It's this network of ancient paths that get you from point A to point B very quickly. And they were built thousands of years ago by great mages. But in the interim, they've become corrupted. Like, it used to be beautiful daytime. Now it's pitch black. There's this...
A lot of ads, billboards around.
Yeah, a vampiric wind that eats souls. So basically the same thing.
Yeah, okay. Stuck on the blue route.
So the notion of they're very risky to use, but... You can, if you need to, very quickly traverse a large distance, but so can your enemies. So occasionally entire armies just pop up outside your door. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of that being a threat to mages. Like, hey, we've discovered this path. We don't know where it leads or what's at the other end or what might come through. Possibly a vampiric star squid. Who knows?
As you do.
As one does. You could also have one of the Wick themselves just kind of in a little hut off the side, I guess. That would be fun.
Coincidentally, I picked something once again nearly identical to you as the next thing to bring up.
Mm.
And that is the idea of the first ones.
Yeah.
That we get the idea across Mage and some other lines that humans or something before humans got to do more. This may be because they were divine in some way. The Celestial Chorus calls it the many that broke off from the one. Early humans are... Pre-modern humans could have been part of that. They may have been in direct conversation with God, or it may just have been there were so few people back then, the gods had more time to spend with each individual thing. It's like kind of what it's like when you're the firstborn and then suddenly there's a sibling and you just get less attention. This is where it starts going off the rails. If you look at Demon the Fallen, there was the time of Babel during the Age of Wrath, which starts the Silent War, this kind of highly abstract competition where no true violence takes place between the host and those rebelling. Later, Cain invents murder. I always like the line, invents murder, where he's like, well, this stone, if I hit him and I just keep going,
I'm gonna patent that.
And then suddenly the angels are all like, well, that's a thing. And Lucifer goes, well, time to bring them up to our level. And the 10 watchers visit humanity to give them not just the gifts of the knowledge of earth, but the knowledges of heaven. This is ultimately too much for humans. It shatters. And then we have the tribes of humanity form, which raises questions also about the Nephilim, the children of humans and demons. This sounds like a weird area of, I don't know, did this actually happen? But Mage, in one of the rare cases where it's like, F you, we're giving you metaphysical certainty, is like, here is the 7-point Nephilim / Laham merit. I can find no origin for Laham except for it is apparently the Arabic word for meat in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, Laham.
Yeah, I want an entire book of these, like, human whatever cross creatures, like in the same way in Exalted we have the god-blooded, the demon-blooded, the ghost-blooded, and so on. So
the meat-blooded.
The meat-blooded. So my weird theory is that the Wick and all these other proto-creatures were actually a predecessor of Homo sapiens. They were Homo heidelbergensis, the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, or maybe the last of the Homo erectus. They didn't die out, but due to their close relationship with the Earth, as humans kind of spread, they became bygones and departed from Earth. Maybe Homo sapiens were terrified because of their capability with magic, and there just became so many of us that we were able to just use our magic of spear, fire, and rope to more or less kill them. And if you want to go one level further, since humans and since Homo sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis interbred, I would like to argue that avatars are merely the leftover souls of the Neanderthals.
Gasp.
That is latent genetic material that is being activated. The problem with that is different peoples have kind of different proportions of Neanderthal DNA, and I don't want to be like, oh, no, you can't do it.
Listeners can't see me waving my hand.
There's some hand waving happening.
Yeah.
But this is now my weirdest fan theory.
Isn't there something with the pure ones that maybe I'm crossing bits of lore?
The term pure one is used in at least two different ways in Mage, and that's a little bit frustrating. We have the verbena use, and then we have the everyone else use.
Well, so what's the one then with, not the Kwisatz Haderach, the progenitor of like the Ali Batin shattering itself forward and backward in
time? Oh, the Kwisatz Al-Akbar.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't pure one, but there was some element of that was like, oh, maybe that's the earliest mages. So they got the shards of it that went furthest back in time or something like that. I came across it when I was looking up, I think, information about the Ali Batin.
Yeah, there were two different ones where one is that there is an ultimate moment of ascension that occurs in the far future that they try to reach back to give humanity the ability to ascend earlier, to shortcut all of the suffering, but it kind of touches reality and shatters.
Right, like tossing a precious vase back in time.
Yes. Yeah. It contains an important message written on a very fragile vase.
We failed to catch it because we'd bred out all of our Neanderthal.
The other one is you have the Night of Fauna, which is a moment of entelechy, and that divine wisdom shatters, and that forms the avatars that could theoretically give us the ability to do something of something. Every once in a while, I encounter a mage term that you think is tied to something else, but then you Google it, and you're like, oh, this is literally never been mentioned elsewhere in human philosophy.
I mean, I'm trying to put together the Greek in my head, and here's the term in Aristotelian metaphysics: the complete realization and final form of some potential concept or function, or the conditions under which a potential thing becomes actualized. All right.
Ladies.
So in terms of putting one of these into a game, whether it's the Wick or the pure ones or whatever, I do think there has to be a very good reason for them being anywhere but the deepest umbra or the most distant past, because it's like, why would they need or want to interact at this point with human mages at all? And we don't really get information on how they might have behaved, what they looked like, or whatever. There is, though, if you take the suggestion that Lilith is one of them, in the vampire book Gehenna, there's actually some really, I think, well-done description of Lilith as a character and her psychology, putting aside any issues about her as a figure mythologically. And I think that you could work with it in interesting ways, because she has like her night garden and she has powers that don't really line up with any other supernatural type.
Yeah, kind of the ones that came out to me was the powers of these early humans seem to be wide ranging. One of the ones that I thought was interesting is naming. They seem to be involved in setting the basic nature of things or being able to discern or define it. You have a group that needs to find the last caveman to lift Dark Fate, remove the curse of Cain, maybe grant someone the ability to do magic. They seem to have a superior ability to commune with the gods or spirits. That, again, that may just be because there are a few people lying around. They'd be like, hey, God. God's like, I don't have anything else to do. Sure, I'll talk to this guy. Maybe they need to find the language of the Magdalenian, which is the Lascaux cave people, to quell an angry elemental. Something that deep from the earth that has roused. And I like the idea that the first human umbral realms were tied to like Cuevas de las Manos, Göbekli Tepe, Lascaux Cave, these kind of very ancient sites that whenever you look at them, you're like, oh, I get it. Kind of in the same way that everyone I know that has visited the Rift Valley in Kenya has like this deep, oh, this is where we came from. like in your bones.
Yeah, it's eerie though, think about it.
They may be beings capable of exceptional binding. I like the idea that they are the entities that wrote the Oaths of Gold from Dark Ages Fae, that they are the only ones that are able to do that. Another option is that they were so close and enlightenment was so obvious that a lot of them just kind of immediately ascended.
And it was done like, with this.
Yeah. And we were just, humanity is kind of the leftover dumb ones who weren't able to figure it out. But like the presentation of them being dumb or less intelligent is kind of a trope I've leaned away from, because like once you have anatomically modern humans, it's just kind of a function of it being raised. One of the things I thought would be interesting is that there are early human settlements in the Umbra, that there is an ancient sector of the digital web that represents the first communication or the first prayer, that deep beneath the ground of the high Umbra, there is the first abstract thoughts of humanity, the Chomskyan idea of language being predicated on merge. So
it's fine.
I think it is hard to ignore Chomsky's contribution to linguistics.
For sure.
Yes. Anything else you may think about the fellow. He did also give us the greatest research animal name, Nim Chimpsky.
Fair.
So I'm behind that. But the idea that deep below the ground of the high Umbra, there is the realm of merge, and that there is a new concept that needs to be created, and this is the only place to do it. And they could still be out there, that they are just lives so magical and simple that we just don't notice it. This almost hidden parallel society, kind of in the same way that I can't remember the term. What is the thing in Changeling where you have a perfect balance between your fey and your human part?
Shihan.
Thanks.
Yes.
And I don't get the sense that I've read remarkably little about them, but I refer to them as having a tenured position in the humanities at a small liberal arts college where you do MFAs.
And you just never retire.
Exactly. But them being so at balance that they almost go unnoticed. Like,
yeah. Well, and it's Changeling Golconda, to use the vampire term. It's actually one of the things that C20 changed in a way that I'm not wild about, because now they're more presented as being the embodiments of mythemes, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, I still like, but it's a very thing, different, but you know.
And I also like presenting Golconda as not necessarily a good thing, but that's me.
Yeah.
Do you really want to be? Like in first edition, early editions, it was the beast was quelled. And in later editions, it's you're at balance with your beast. What does that mean? I have reached balance with my inner Wolverine. What is that?
When you're talking about Noam Chomsky, actually, it kind of makes me think, I love drawing in media references out of nowhere. So I think they're the ones that sent the monoliths in 2001.
Okay.
Like that's kind of the role I see for them. Because actually, I'll throw another one in. The Sandman series by Neil Gaiman, there was a collection of short stories that came out, I think, after the comics had ended. And it was all stories set within that universe, but very disparate. One of them was set at the dawn of, I guess, civilization, like 30,000 years ago. Yeah. And it follows the protagonist who has discovered language doesn't have to, you can lie. And realizing they're the only person that realizes that. And I think it's Dream who like shows up and says like, well, now that you figured this out, let me tell you a thing or two about how the world works. So I like the Wick or the Pure Ones or whomever as that. They're the ones that put the innateness of language into humans because they're the ones that had that moment of like, oh, right. And that to me is much more impressive than like Iteration X claiming they invented fire or whatever. I see that role for them. I do think though that most players, most tables probably wouldn't go in that direction, even though I feel like they should, and instead would gravitate towards the thing I think you shouldn't do, which is a Wick shows up and says, I need your help, mortal mages, to defeat this other Wick. Like that, I think, is what people want to do with them. And I would be like, no, don't do that.
Yeah, the thing that keeps recurring to me is like they were ancient and powerful, but like what they were doing was probably in terms of mathematics, like early Western cultures viewed things as being two different sets of numbers that you kind of had quantity and proportion, and they were separate concepts. And it took centuries to kind of combine the two to be like, oh, numbers are numbers. We can kind of do whatever we want with them. And that requiring a breakthrough in the same way that you look at who was it that nearly invented calculus like three or four times?
I hope it's like John Dee.
Was it Archimedes? But like basically there was this Greek mathematician who's like, okay, oh, this is interesting. If I just keep increasing the number of sides to a polygon, I'm approaching a circle, which could just have infinite sides, but that doesn't mean anything. So I'm not going to do it.
I think that is, that sounds like Archimedes. Yeah. Cause I remember that.
You were like steps away from it. Who almost invented calculus.
You can find it first. Antiphon, and then specifically Eudoxus of Cnidus and Lin Hui in China.
That there were a number of people that were like, well, infinity is stupid, so we're not going to do this. Or in some cases are offensive to the gods or nonsensical. And you're just like, we were so close.
Also Euclid and Archimedes.
That there were just these kind of moments, and they were just there. And kind of in every one of these turns, there was someone exceptional who had to do that. And just the idea that kind of the insight or ability to do that so early in human history kind of made these people different. But at the same time, it was probably like necessary for survival, or you could view it as a commentary. This is what you can do when your life is uncluttered.
I'm going to float an idea. What if one of them, at least, is one of the masters of the Nafandi, and it's whoever first realized the equivalency of zero and nothing? Just going to throw that out there. And
I think that's fine with that. The Wick are actually each just entities that created some great thing. And because of the nature of discovery, they are wrapped up in it in some way, that they are now these mythopoetic creatures, that they are the mythemes, if you want, as I use a term that I have just heard for the first time an hour and a half ago, to do that. And yes, the Wick are not even the idea, not even just fire, but the idea of spark or generation or heat or something like that, and are now these very powerful entities kind of tied up with it, who have achieved this weird, they came before an era where a name could be remembered. They were pre-Gilgamesh, as it were, and thus could not live in that name, but instead live somehow in the concept of it.
Mm. They're like oracles of things beyond spheres.
Yeah, kind of. Or things more fundamental basic than spheres.
That's like, I know you're a fan of this branch of, I don't know, historical mythology, whatever you want to call it, but the idea of the Me in Sumer.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, you have these technologies handed down by the gods, but they include things like kingship as a concept, and that blurry line between like physical technologies and social technologies and intellectual or cultural technologies.
Democracy is a technology. Rights are a technology. Yeah. And I think they're pretty cool.
So I like that idea for them as well, as being, you know, they have these godlike qualities, but they are also in some capacity very on a human level in terms of understanding what can catalyze widespread change.
The other explanation of why they're gone is, so you bring up the mess, which I love. Some of them were stolen. Like in one story, we got God drunk and we stole all of his wisdom.
Yep.
And I can't remember specifically which God and under what circumstances. And the God goes, well, I want to steal it back. And they're like, well, they got you drunk. They stole it fair and square. And God's like,
The Tree of Knowledge, like that story has the same kind of.
But I like the idea that like in creating these concepts, each of the Wick kind of had to sacrifice themselves in some way to it, that in some critical way, they are each a different Prometheus. And the reason they are gone is that to create the world that we knew, to domesticate it to the point where we were not consumed by the void, that the concept of zero was not able to destroy us, was because enough of them kind of sacrificed themselves to cool reality to the point where there was the shell that humans could then occupy. So to commune with the Wick is to master all of mathematics, is to understand the creation of all creativity. And now to commune with them, you more or less have to do something like sacrifice a university. In some way. I would not say sacrifice in terms of you have to kill all of them, but like you have the changeling idea that you can consume so much glamour from a mortal they are never able to generate it again, that you have to create this edifice of knowledge and then in some way extinguish it. Not kill everyone, but that is the way in which you are able to commune with these great beings. And only once. So now you have this game of centuries where characters are trying to contact these first beings or have put together this kind of national treasure-like clue that exists throughout all of culture to try and reach to them. But
weirdly, you're saying this, and the thought that I'm having is this would actually make for a great mage game, but it would also make for an amazing Promethean game. Like, if that's what it means to come full circle, is for a Promethean, like if they're the ones who have enough humanity in them but are separated from it enough that they are the next generation of beings able to again put forth these concepts drawn from their experience that have never been seen before.
And I like the idea of that is in the same way that we had the book Ascension to kind of end Mage. I think that would be a pretty fascinating way to end Promethean.
I'm writing it in my notes.
We're getting a Storyteller Vault book. So that got pretty out there.
Yes. let's bring it in.
Any other strange peoples from the World of Darkness before we talk about the
alternative
other ones?
No, I have another non-World of Darkness to talk about.
But. Yeah, and so there are other types of being that exist in other games that we think are interesting, and we're like, why not steal one or two of those? Pook, what do you got?
So I have the Vagabonds from Second Edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. To my knowledge, they only appear in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Psionics Handbook from that edition, and they might have popped up somewhere else instead, but I thought they were the coolest things when I was a tween. And the Psionics Handbook is a banger of a supplement, even if they didn't really mechanize psionic powers in a scalable and sustainable way. I suspect Mage, the Mage system for psychic powers probably works better, and you could. In any case, it's the book that made me want to do psionic role-playing. I will briefly also tell an anecdote of how my brother, when we were, you know, doing D&D growing up, there's a wild talent psionics table. So if you're playing a barbarian or whatever, you can roll
a
D100.
You have like a 2% chance or whatever it is of getting a minor. But yeah, and if you get a double zero, you get to roll again.
So he had a halfling character. He wanted to make a halfling ninja.
Okay, as you do.
As one does. And the world in which we were going to be playing was psionics was outlawed. So it was all wild talent. And halflings have I think the slimmest chance of developing any kind of power. So he rolled and he rolled 0-0, which is roll on the heavy duty table, rolled on that and rolled a 98. And so it was like roll three times. So we ended up having eight different powers, I think, four of which were the heavy duty powers as this halfling ninja named Shorty the Fist. So it became this running character. I hated that he was so lucky. Anyway. The Vagabonds. They are hyper-intelligent alien creatures that visit our plane and mimic the forms of other intelligent animals or humanoids. And that doesn't necessarily mean they could be dolphins. They could be whatever. Their natural form is described as being like a blob of ink, which grows and fills out into a three-dimensional silhouette before details like skin tone and equipment and everything are added. Awesome. They can also inhabit a freshly dead body, like various possessing spirits, or occupy a living body by dwelling in the back of their minds, like a Chulorvia, perhaps. They don't gain knowledge or anything like that by mimicry or possession, so they might seem awkward or amiss to a casual observer. Like they don't have if they're possessing someone, they don't have their life experience to draw upon. They paper over this deficiency with what were, at the time, the most potent psionic traits in the game, I believe. So, going through the list here, they can never learn psychokinesis, but they have powers that let them learn things quickly, change forms, travel, they're expert telepaths, and they have metapsionics, so they can manipulate psionic powers. Yeah. As a whole. Apparently they're also fond of mind swapping. Part of the charm for me is the fact that after this one page reference in this book, they are never mentioned again. So because they're super curious, they're super intelligent, they're happy to help adventurers, which is a rarity among D&D monsters, and if they leave the material plane, they're gone forever. Huh. Like, they visit once, and then they're gone. So I like the idea of working that into a mage game with a character who is truly not what they seem, having them be a one-off being unlike anything else that the mages have encountered. They can take the form of a familiar rather than a person, which I think adds an interesting hook. So like their true nature might not become apparent until much later down the line. And then they might want to experience some aspect of human existence that seems really mundane to mages, but they want to do it in like the most extreme or off-kilter way possible. So like
master the art of crème fraîche. Yeah.
For example. Or like the color green or morality or whatever. There's a lot of variation. So they could teach a new approach to mind magic, you know, in terms of their role in the story, or you could have them as like mysterious guys in a psychics game, like a psychic sorcerer's game. They're thinly described in the source material, but I think you can bring in lots of tropes associated with shapeshifters, or really like a one-time mimic with no motive other than curiosity. Combine that with off-the-chart mental powers and completely inhuman ways of looking at things, and I think you have a really compelling being to introduce.
I think it's also interesting because it answers the question of what do we do when Jim doesn't show up?
Yes.
And we're like, okay, how do we turn Jim into an NPC for precisely one session?
Or Jim's familiar.
Yeah. Jim brings Jim's boyfriend, and suddenly we need one character for one night. And we're just like, here are 17 powers you have. You get to use each of them once.
Yep.
Let's see what happens.
And to give them powers that are, from a mage perspective, completely off the chain, like, give them the arch spheres. Why not? Just mind our
but only for the investigation of the concept of the color green. Or they can't use it against anyone left-handed or like any set of weird restrictions that they have. I just assumed when you were going to bring up the coolest creatures from the Psionics Handbook, it was either going to be the brain mole or the weird psionic mites.
There's also the weird psionic elephants.
Yes.
Those are also in there too. I
forgot about the psionic
and the
elephants.
The emaciated primates. There's a whole bunch of weird.
Yeah, they're the mind ape. Apparently they receive mention at some point in Spelljammer, possibly, but this is just a weird internet. Oh yeah, the cerebral parasites. Bleed psionic. Thanks, CloudFront. But yeah, now I need to track down one of these on eBay. I also remember that book for having some of the worst art. Because it was just like, here's a head with a door.
Yeah.
And it had like subtitles and so on.
They clearly contracted some like early 90s photo, you know, photo mashup.
Yeah, collage. The thing that I also find interesting is the sheer number of playtesters that went into this. More people playtested this one book than I think playtested any of the X20 books combined. And you're just like, oh, wow, D&D was a behemoth. So, and all of this was written by Steve Winter, because this was an era when people just went into a dark room and produced entire books. This is what life was like before social media, people. But yeah, I found a 6-page sample, because as with all good things, this is available online in its entirety from Scribd.
I did bring my hard copy.
That's in surprisingly good condition, seemingly, too.
Well, it lives on my shelf and it basically never goes
out. But from my understanding of your peripatetic life, it's probably been moved 17 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
15.
Yeah, and each time it takes 1 point of bashing damage, so.
Thought Eater. Thought Eaters are natives of the border ethereal, and they only survive in ethereal form. They appear as a sickly gray skeletal body with an oversized platypus head to those who can observe it. They have webbed skeletal paws suited to swimming through the ether.
The weird thing I picked that was just as reasonable are the Elderbrin from Invisible Sun. Take a drink. They're a group of quicksilver shape-shifting creatures that are native to the Gold Sun, which is the sun of change and renewal. They shift their appearance and can use it as a way of communicating. They are generally different from humans in that they do not seek to change the world to accommodate them, but seek to adapt themselves to the world. They live in large families and have the ability to quickly communicate through their lineages, so they can easily communicate to anyone else they are related to. They are fundamentally creatures of magic. They don't share quite a hive mind, but they have the ability to communicate thoughts to each other through a network known as the Fey Lines. The younger ones, it is concerning, they have seemingly started to want things, which is new to them. They are a strange alien intelligence that tends to move through the worlds. They are kind of a mirror to human intelligence, suited for life outside of shadow. And they constantly mutter cryptic phrases to each other, such as, being is on its way. The Elderbrin may be tied to the legacy, which is a collection of divine objects tied to the creation of the actuality, which is the invisible sun term for all that is. There's the idea that there is a central point in time that all past and future is radiating from. So the very newest and oldest things are actually the most recently created, and that there is some event that we are all kind of racing towards, that center of creation. The Elderbrin are about freedom, and capturing one causes it to give a big sigh and to simply disappear. They believe strongly in the right to be remade. They may hold the key to inverting an Aphondus, taking someone back from madness, ascending the Black Spiral, or reuniting the pieces of the One. They, to me, can just be weird creatures that remind you that you are in a weird part of the Umbra. Kind of a counterpart to them are the Lacuna, which are these kind of sentient portals that always display a path to another place. They can be traveled through, which is, I don't know if that is considered intimate or rude or kinky or what, but they tend to operate businesses and are also kind of creatures of magic. And I just kind of like the strange creatures that are populating the actuality. The Invisible Sun kind of monster manual Teratology is, I think, one of the best places to look outside of Mage for additional weird beings and creatures. It has one of my favorite quotes in it of how many creatures are there in the actuality, to which the answer is all of them. Mm. Any thoughts on plumbing other games for weird creatures to jam into Mage, or any thoughts on the Elderbrin?
Well, I have thoughts on the Lacuna primarily, in the sense of, like, do they have, are they three-dimensional? Like,
They're implied to be able to handle and manipulate objects, yeah, which suggests that they are, but they are largely drawn as being flat, but able to, like, wrap themselves around things. I don't know if they can, like, slide under doors and such.
Yeah. And at what point does their portalness end? Like, okay, if they're walking down the street and they trip over something and they land on a fire hydrant, does the fire hydrant go through into the other place and they're flat on the ground? Like, how does that work, you know? Those are all questions.
This is why there's no fire hydrants in Saturnine. So,
so for other games, though, it occurred to me that most of the other games I play are generally, there's not that many, like, compelling alien things out there. I mean, even D&D, so many of them, I mean, they're just elves with different, you know, yeah, with cosmetic changes. Like, they're too comprehensible almost, or their goals are not interesting enough to stand out. Something like the Vagabonds, they have a clear, distinct purpose that's almost orthogonal to everybody else's. And they're like those comets that come once and then are gone. And I like that as, you know, for the one-off stuff that isn't part of the world.
The one that I find interesting is within the game Ashen Stars, which is a gumshoe game, one of the alien species is this group that ascended onto a plane of pure thought and have moved beyond the mortal coil and so on. But for whatever reason, a couple of them, like, fell out. So they have reached the state of ascension and then deascended. And some of them are like, ah, crap, got to get back. But other ones are like, yeah. That was fun. Let's try having a go of it. So they have these wild mental powers and they have transparent skulls. So their brains are always visible. And some of them just kind of want to make money and just have bacchanalian delight in the few, as they describe it, tens of thousands of years before everyone is screwed or something like that.
There you go.
And I just kind of like that as an idea. But yeah, you mentioned having frequently is the case of, oh, you have an elf with slightly different culture. The ones I kind of look to are the slow empires of the anime, because what is it like to portray a character whose scale of thought is centuries or millennia, or on the other end where you will live for a year or something like that? Life expectancy to me is one of the ones that's kind of interesting that I wish games did better playing with. And there's always the idea of having, like, domain level play where, like, each turn is a different generation or something like that. But that kind of generating and creating that cast of characters and passing the baton forward in time is, needless to say, hard to do.
I have an idea, actually, for a mage fiction that I want to write at some point, where I'm going to stat up a character with the Mayfly curse flaw and then put them through a story, because why not? You know, it's like, because, yeah, I think that an interesting way to shift the perspective of a character is, and even, I mean, putting the Slow Empire aside, even the Shi in Changeling are said to have this very bizarre relationship with time. She's greatest nostalgia is for breakfast, as they say.
But do they say that?
It is somewhere in the books, but okay. I forget where.
So, Pook, what are you working on these days? Anything that we should know about or keep our eyes open for? Of course, we have our recently released yes. Sphere of Gun project.
Yeah.
That was speaking great. Of violence, we're just like, this book's going to exist. And then it did.
It just happened. No, aside from that, I am working on a couple changeling projects. The next one will probably be a deep dive into the Augmen. Possibly will be out by the time this recording is released. After that, I'm resolving to finish the New York Changeling book that I've been working on off and on for 2 years now, I guess. More mage stuff to follow.
Yeah, we're going to have to do our Philly book at some point in some way. I just don't know what it is or where it is.
I had a moment a couple of weeks ago. I went home for making the family Easter bread, which is a tradition that we've been doing in this country for over 100 years. And my mom's cousin was there. He's probably 82 at this point. Very mild-mannered, very reserved, kind of in that, you know, old man stage of his life, doesn't say much. But then out of nowhere, I brought up the fact that I'm living in South Philly. South Street came up and he just interjected out of nowhere, "Is Harry's Occult Shop still there?" And it very much took me aback. He's a good Catholic, I believe. So,
and I mean, Harry's Occult Shop is still there. And
well, in its new space. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and is open today until 6.
Hey.
The Metaphysical Bookstore. Maybe we do a field trip to that and that becomes our first one.
There must be one in Baltimore too.
I hope so. Possibly even a Harry's. I can subscribe to their newsletter. Hot cha. Pook, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where we'll always listen to your off-the-wall fan theory as long as it doesn't just reduce to anti-Semitism, because seemingly a third of the time the real kooky ones do. This show has been brought to you by its executive producers, who you can join at patreon.com/magethepodcast. First, we have the oracles of variously non-anatomically modern human hominins. That was ambiguous. Ben Bendelow, Oracle of Homo habilis, the first user of stone tools. Buck Gregory, Oracle of Homo erectus, who likely first used fire. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the Neanderthals, where 80 to 95% of specimens that we have show that the individual had recovered from a major injury. Guy Stewart, Oracle of the Denisovans, who likely could also interbreed between Neanderthals and modern humans. Jay Widener, Oracle of Homo naledi, who also buried their dead. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of Homo heidelbergensis, which may be the common ancestors of Neanderthals and humans. Mikhail, Oracle of Homo rhodesiensis, previously thought independent of heidelbergensis, but it's probably the same. Pukaji, Oracle of Homo florentiensis, nicknamed the Hobbit because they were quite short. Sean Gallagher, Oracle of Cro-Magnon, or early modern man who showed sophisticated art. The crew of Erebus, Oracle of Australopithecus afarensis, whose fossil Lucy showed early evidence of bipedalism in early hominins. St. UX player, Oracle of Australopithecus africanus, which showed both bipedalism and tool use. Jason Vines, Oracle of Parathropus boisei, who had a very strong jaw and was nicknamed Nutcracker Man. And Derek Simsek, Oracle of Homo luzonensis, which had modern teeth, but feet suggested that it was capable of climbing trees. Along with Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Michael Parker, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Wolf Larryson, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwank, Fragarock, George Laura, Gray Trillig H., Henry Kraft, Hugo the Bog Person, Ia Bolt, Jason Duncan, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jen, Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Jolyn Andes, Laws and Stuff, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Manel Canos, Matthew Prohl, Maurice Hopkins, Michael Creedle, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Pax Cow, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Sploid, Sev Nessus, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Steve Winyard, Thrice Great, Tyler Bryan, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Conley, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out this episode goes to Mano Canos, who sounds like Flannel Manos, or Flannel Hands in very poor Spanish. Here are some flannel facts. Flannel originated in Wales in the 17th century, and it was made out of carded wool or worsted yarn. Today it's made of all sorts of things. Its soft texture comes from napping, which involves brushing the fabric to raise fibers, or from using a very loosely spun yarn. Its warmth and breathability comes from a mix of a loose weave, which allows air through, and a bulkier weave, which holds more heat. Flannel is generally woven as twill, creating a diagonal pattern or plain weave with its common 1/1 pattern. You usually don't see this as it's ultimately covered in napping. Don't confuse flannel with plaid. Flannel is the fabric, and plaid is the pattern. Whenever I see flannel pants, I'll think of you, Manel. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube for our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hobbin Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also on Mastodon at dice.camp at magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.